The first major problem we have in the United States is that obesity treatment is not a standard benefit on our insurance policy, despite the fact that the American Medical Association declared obesity a disease in 2013. So that was, 11 years ago. We still have to, obesity treatment is still a carve out on insurance plans. And that's what we need to, that's what we advocate for, that I advocate for at the personal level, as well as at the Obesity Medicine Association level, is that we need to make it a standard benefit. Like, in other words, you don't, you know, insurance companies don't, you know, charge extra for cancer or, you know, rheumatoid arthritis or Alzheimer's or these other diseases that we have, right? They're not carved out of an insurance plan. They're included when an employer gets insurance for their employees. You know, they know that they have inclusion of all these diseases if their employees get those diseases, right? But that's not the case with obesity, and we need to fix that tomorrow. Like, in my opinion, as a public health emergency.
Sure.
The problem is that there's 140 million Americans in the United States alone that qualify for treatment. 140 million.
Wow.
Prior to these effective medications, we were only treating 1% of the people that. 1% of those 140 million people occurring even now, like we're in the 5 to 10% treatment category, but that's still 10 million, you know, 11 million patients.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the All Out Coach podcast. My name is Tim Michalashvili. I'm your host, also CEO and co-founder of Amedev Pharma, performance analytics agency in life sciences that uses a unique deep metrics formula to measure patient and employee experience in a new digital solution launching soon. Today's podcast is live on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram as well, which means that you can ask questions, post your comments. So we're very excited. Today, I'm going to be speaking to a leader who emanates hope, purpose, and care as soon as you speak to her or you meet her. She shines a bright light of optimism as well as a call to action, which I have a feeling we're all going to have in the treatment of obesity at the end of this conversation. Angela Fitch, my special guest today, is president of the Obesity Medicine Association, chief medical officer of KnownWell, assistant professor of medicine at Harvard, former co-director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Weight Center. She's an activist in obesity medicine, and she's going to tell us all the latest hype, the shortage, and the reality that faces our patients, providers from multiple perspectives in this global topic that's evolving so rapidly. I'm so fortunate to have Dr. Angela Fitch with me today. Welcome to All Out Coach.
Tim, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. As you mentioned, it's a serious chronic disease that is currently being undertreated in our country and the world, actually. So very timely topic.
You know, as I reflected on my podcast, the guests that I invite are usually the inspiration for our audience, my personal inspiration for what we want to accomplish. And this is why I'm interested in what your inspiration was to not only become a specialist in obesity medicine, but also an activist as well.
Tim, that's a great question. I think I started my career as a primary care physician. So I was I'm board certified in internal medicine and pediatrics. So I'm double boarded, which means I took care of the whole family, you know, from birth to death, right, as a primary care doctor. I've always had a love for everything related to metabolism. I've always been fascinated with human metabolism. I have a chemical engineering undergraduate degree. And during my chemical engineering undergraduate degree, I actually did essentially biomedical engineering. And back in the 90s, there really wasn't, to be a biomedical engineer, you had to go to graduate school. So in undergrad, I worked with a professor who was modeling human exercise from a exercise expenditure, you know, caloric expenditure standpoint. He was developing a computer model. Now, this was back in the days of Fortran. And if for anybody out there that's a computer person, I don't think we use Fortran anymore, but maybe we do. I don't know, but that's what we learned. And we had punch cards and everything. It was, you know, not the age of computers that we have today. And so I just really have always loved everything related to, you know, how the human body functions as a chemical engineering, you know, plant, right? Like essentially. So during, as I was doing primary care for 10 years, I just really, you know, patients would come in and say, well, how do I lose weight? You know, how do I tackle this problem I have? And I, you know, as a doctor, I was like, well, no one ever taught us, you know, other than just eat less and exercise more, you know, use this app and track your calories and try to get more exercise, right? I mean, that was what we were recommending. And I thought to myself, there's got to be something better. And that was the time when, you know, when I started practice was when the first GLP-1s became available as drugs for diabetes treatment. And in seeing those work so miraculously for a lot of people, right, from a metabolism standpoint, it just really fascinated me. And then that took me into, you know, becoming board certified in obesity medicine and essentially, you know, self-training myself, because back then we had very little, you know, fellowships in obesity or anything like that. You had to just kind of go to conferences. And I shadowed one of my mentors was at the University of Minnesota. And I just went and Dr. Charlie Billington is his name, one of the first people who did obesity, you know, treatment. And I just went and hung out in clinic with him and learned from him. And interesting, even back in those days, the early 2000s, he was talking about obesity phenotypes, about the fact that there are different obesities, that obesity isn't one condition. And that was back in the early 2000s when he had this idea that, you know, that this is a very heterogeneous chronic disease. And you know, again, that was, you know, 2003, 2004. So, I mean, this isn't a new concept, right? It's just that it's gotten a lot more attention because our treatments are so much more effective.
Yeah. You know, I was starting out my career in those years, as I had mentioned to you when we met at the Financial Times conference at Sanofi Aventis. So one of the first products that I was supporting was Rimonabant for obesity for and smoking cessation and endocannabinoid receptor antagonist. So how far have we come since then in terms of advances? What is that hype all about?
Yeah, and it's more than just hype, right? It's actual reality, you know, in the sense that our older medications, which, you know, we'll use phentermine topiramate as sort of the classic example of our medication that's been around, you know, for the longest time that we've had access to. Both of those drugs as generic medications have been around, you know, for, you know, since the 1950s, 1960s, maybe a little bit later for topiramate. But the point is that we've had these drugs for quite some time. So the issue is that with that combination medication, phentermine and topiramate combined, about 15% of people are able to lose 20% of their weight with that treatment. Okay. Our newer medications take semaglutide, 2.4 milligrams for obesity, which is Wegovy. 40% of people, 40% of people now are able to lose that same 20% weight. So we went from 15% of people being able to get 20% weight loss to 40% of people. Right? That's more than double the amount of people were able to get into that category. And now with tirzepatide or Zepbound, you know, for weight management, Zepbound, 60% of people are able to get into that 20% weight loss category. So we're getting, you know, with surgery, we have about 80% of people, at least initially, able to get into that 20% weight loss category. So again, you know, we're getting closer to, you know, surgery has always been our sort of gold standard as far as the highest level of treatment, so to speak, you know, highest intensity of treatment. And now we're getting closer to that, you know, amount of weight loss with a medication, or that amount of efficacy with a medication. And so again, with retatrutide coming, you know, in studies right now, you know, being studied, then you're looking at 80% of people, at least in those early studies, getting to that 20% weight loss category, which is, again, now very similar to surgery. Now, the benefit of surgery is you don't have to take a medication. So I still think that surgery is very much, should very much still be an option for patients, because there are side effects to medications, and not everybody can tolerate those side effects. Yeah. You know, just because you're getting 80% of people getting 20% weight loss, if half of those are living miserably, that's not a good treatment either. So we have to balance all of that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned retatrutide. Can you tell the audience its mechanism? Does it work differently from the others? Or what do you attribute to that higher efficacy to?
Yeah, retatrutide is a triple agonist, right? So it activates GLP-1, GIP, and glucagon receptors. So it is got three different mechanisms of treatment, whereas, okay, you know, tirzepatide has two mechanisms of treatment, which is a GLP-1 and GIP, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have semaglutide, which is one mechanism of treatment, which is GLP-1. So you're adding on more and more of these incretin effects, right? With mm-hmm. these nutrient stimulating hormones. Whereas with surgery, you might have five or six different hormonal changes, right? With surgery. So again, okay, you know, surgery is sort of our penultimate, you know, treatment, because it affects multiple of these neuroendocrine hormones. You know, by having surgery, you're getting, you know, similar effects to drugs like you know, semaglutide and tirzepatide and retatrutide.
Mm-hmm. Is there any factor that predicts success in treatment? Because look, nowadays, whether or not you are obese, you probably have heard of Ozempic, or you know somebody of a friend or somebody who has used it, whether or not it's really indicated, right? Is there, you know, particular trend that you've seen as you treat exclusively obesity patients with obesity, correct?
Right. And as you said it, Tim, it's patients with obesity, right? We like to talk about, not about, you know, people being right, obese, but patients with obesity, because it really is a chronic disease, right? That we shouldn't be sort of labeled by, you know, because yeah, there has been a lot of bias and stigma in the world of, you know, because ever since
I learned that in your lecture, by the way.
Ever since Hippocrates, right? There's data to show Hippocrates quoting, you know, Hippocrates is the first physician, right, in 500 BC that sure, he's sure, credited with being the first, you know, sort of physician of his time, right, of mm-hmm. our time. And, you know, even back then, he said that the way you treat obesity is to eat less and exercise more, right? I mean, and so we've been fighting against that. I mean, you know, that has been the sort of standard of care, so to speak, for centuries. And yet we've recognized that that's not easy to do. Like, in other words, that treatment is not very effective. You know, the issue is the standard of care just wasn't very effective. Just like back in those days, the standard of care for infection was bloodletting. That wasn't very effective. Right. Like we developed antibiotics and those were much more effective, right? And so again, eating less and exercising more is a treatment, but it's not very effective because people can't sustain it long term, right? And yeah, so again, you know, we just have a lot of you know, newer therapies that are just much greater efficacy, and that's what we're looking, you know, forward to the future is how do we attack this now at a public health level? Because it really is becoming a public health emergency, in my opinion, because of the fact that we have a very effective treatment and we can't get access for patients for various reasons.
Sure. Yeah. I'll share with you my personal experience with weight. You know, I have chronic GERD, for example, and it was diet related, I realized. So I changed my diet, lost 20 pounds. I used to be 20 pounds heavier. But you know, just the lifestyle change had helped my condition. It was a kind of diet that basically I've stayed true for, you know, over time. And so when, even though I'm not a nutritionist, when people talk to me about many different diets or things, you know, or their approaches to nutrition, I always tell them to stick to a diet that they know that they will be able to keep. Right.
Exactly.
And yeah, and so I was glad to, you know, hear that from you. You talk also about your five P's in your presentations on nutrition. Maybe we can also just spend a few minutes on talking about your tips on lifestyle-related tips before we go back to the, you know, treatment pharmacological as well.
Well, and what I like to say is we all have to try to manage our lifestyle, meaning in a more healthful manner, because the standard American lifestyle, or the standard American diet, which the acronym for that is SAD, standard American diet, SAD, right? SAD. I know. It is SAD, because the standard American diet is not promoting health and well-being, you know, by nature in our country, meaning highly ultra processed.
Well, right? I know you're highly, board certified pediatrician as well.
Yeah.
Right. Children's diet and in the cafeterias, right?
Yeah. And we can't expect an 8-year old to, you know, to go to the cafeteria and make a choice opposite of what, you know, and these foods are so hyper palatable. I mean, they're engineered, you know, they're made that way by companies that are, I mean, companies are there to make money, right? I mean, all companies exist to make money. They don't, you know, and so they exist to sell more product, and to sell more product, they want to make that product tastier, because the tastier it is, the more they sell. And so again, it is the world that we live in doesn't promote health and well-being by nature anymore. And so we as humans have to figure out how we're going to live into it in a more healthful way. And you know, I had my 5 P's because I made them up for myself, because they fit on one hand, you know, 5 fingers, so I can remember to touch on all the topics. And I did all the P's so I could just remember, you know, when I talk to patients, for example, I should touch on all these issues.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's, and I've categorized them a little bit so I can get more peas, you know, in there, right? So it's planned portions, right? We should have planned portions. So we should plan what we're going to eat, because otherwise, if we're just left to the nature of the world, you know, that's not going to do very well. Portion control, because everything is so large today, right? We have so many larger portions. So planned portions. And then the next P is plants and protein. And then, so those go together because they're both nutritional things. So eat more plants and more protein, right? Plants being vegetables, fruits, whole grains, you know, anything that sort of comes from the earth. Protein being obviously eggs, fish, tofu, yogurt, cottage cheese, et cetera. That's protein, right? Mm-hmm. And then power, because we should all do some strength training for power, right? Strength training is super important. And then pillow, to remind us that we need to sleep well. And then pause, because the last one is pause. And pause is just that we should really take a pause during the nighttime and sort of appreciate our circadian rhythm and not eat, you know, during that nighttime hours. So planned portions, plants and protein. You got it, Tim. Power, pillow, and pause.
Okay, great. Yeah, I want to have some kind of educational you know, points here in our discussion on the lifestyle as well. Yeah. So I appreciate that, and I know I need to kind of watch the last two, especially for myself,
right?
The sleep wise and the pause,
because there's so much in our environment that keeps us awake today, and you know, there's so much going on, and there's so much stress in our world, much more than there was before, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's really, you know, something we all have to try to manage. But we should try to manage that separately from our obesity, meaning those things are things everybody should, you know, work to manage in a more healthful way, right? It's just that as it relates to obesity treatment, we should include those things, certainly, but not rely on those things for a 20% weight loss outcome, if that's what we're trying to achieve. Because only about 5% of people are able to achieve a 20% weight loss with lifestyle intervention.
So it's very important to share with everyone. Okay. So only 5%.
Yeah. When you look at good lifestyle intervention studies where people are doing intensive behavioral therapy, we're talking, you know, having a trainer, having a dietitian to meet with once a week. We're talking intensive behavioral lifestyle studies. About 5% of people are able to achieve that 20% weight loss. And then, you know, the other thing with lifestyle intervention is most people are expected to regain half of that weight over the course of the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. So weight tends to come back on slowly over time. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, in your example of losing, you know, 20 pounds, I just have to guess, maybe that was 10%. I don't know. Maybe it was a little bit more than 10% for you. Like, you know, 15% maybe. So maybe you were in that.
Yeah, about 10%. And I've kept that actually.
Yeah. Right, which is good, right? So you're one of the few people, you know, in that 10% weight loss category. That's about 25% of people with lifestyle. So one out of four people with lifestyle intervention can lose that 10% like you did. Mm-hmm. Now, most people would be expected to gain back, you know, 10 of those pounds over the course of 5 years. So if you've kept that off for 5 years, you're an outlier, right?
I have had my excursions. I do have to confess 5-10 pounds here and there. Yeah.
Because it's very hard to like.
Not 20 at least.
Yeah. It's very hard, right? To maintain weight. It's hard to lose weight and it's hard to maintain it. Those are two separate problems that we should also be starting to look at with research now is looking at both weight loss interventions and weight maintenance interventions, because we've put them traditionally, we've sort of put them into one category, you know, of weight management, but now we're starting to break them apart because we think they might be different biologically, right, in terms of how we address them. And so again, you know, that's another important thing that we're considering for the future, right, is how do we help people lose weight, but then how do we help them maintain it, which might become a different treatment solution? You know, there might be different solutions targeted towards that.
Yeah. Metabolic advantage. This is another concept you talk a lot about. Could you just share with us what that means? How can you gain metabolic advantage if you're a patient with obesity?
Yeah. So by nature, we have a metabolic disadvantage is the problem, right? So meaning that we as humans are engineered, again, going back to my engineering degree, we are engineered to gain weight. So we are created as humans to increase our weight naturally over time. That was protective of us. So it kept us alive on the earth, right? During times of famine, that if we were engineered to lose weight, if our body by default just lost weight, I mean, nobody would be here. We'd all like evolve off the earth. And so you're engineered to gain weight. And so by nature of, if you want to lose weight, then you need a metabolic advantage, right? You need somebody on your team, going back to your sports analogy, right? You need somebody on your team helping you against Mother Nature, right? Mother Nature wants you to put weight back on and you want to keep it off. So you need an additional person on this tug of war, right? Sometimes we depict it as a tug of war, and you need an extra person over here pulling for you, or an extra thing, an extra something. So if you go back to those five P's, right? Those five P's give you a metabolic advantage, we think. Right? The more you sleep, like the less you sleep, the more you tend to gain weight. So again, you know, sleep is a very important factor that a lot of us, you know, don't appreciate as it relates to our weight. Both our appetite changes if we don't sleep, but we also tend to then, you know, store more calories as energy when we don't sleep. So again, it's a metabolic, you know, advantage to get better sleep, better quality sleep. So if you have sleep apnea, treating your sleep apnea helps you with weight loss. So that's one thing. And then it's a metabolic advantage, for example, you know, to do strength training. So the more muscle that you build, the more calories you burn at rest, right? So again, this is how we develop a metabolic advantage. And then I think the ultimate metabolic advantage we have too is medications and surgery. Wow. So, you know, these interventions give us a metabolic advantage against Mother Nature in order to keep our weight off.
Mm-hmm. You did speak about the surgery and you contrasted that with pharmacological options. What does the data show in terms of maintenance of weight loss after surgery versus pharmacologic therapy?
So we don't have good, you know, we certainly don't have head-to-head studies, right? Randomized controlled trials, they're very challenging to do. You know, to randomize someone to surgery or randomize someone to drug treatment is a very challenging study. But if you just look at the data, you know, people do tend to regain weight after surgery. And so again, you know, patients are expected to regain about 20% of the weight they lost after surgery, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years. So again, you know, they do tend to regain weight. And depending on when you have surgery, right? If you have surgery at 14 years old, right, you have another, you know, 80, 90 years of life left, right? To have, you know, weight gain continue to potentially happen after that procedure. So again, one of the advantages of pharmaceutical therapy, at least what we've seen so far, is that as long as you stay on pharmaceutical therapy, you maintain the weight loss. So that's a little bit different than surgery, right? In that, right. But then again, if you have 10 years of after surgery where you don't have to take a medication, there's certainly a cost benefit there. And there's also, meaning you're not taking a medication that costs money every year. And then there's also the benefit of you just don't have to take a medication with the side effects, et cetera. But it's important to recognize that this is a chronic disease that we're treating that affects people across their lifetime. And for 20% of our adolescents that have obesity today, that is a huge issue for them, you know, across their lifespan. It's one in five adolescents that are going to have to deal with this for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's clear that there are advances in treatments for obesity. They're complex, but also there are lots of questions to be solved, which is that shortage that I learned about speaking to you at the obesity conference recently. I know as a pharmacist, I know that there's an overall drug shortage, but it's particularly affecting obesity treatments as well. So can you describe this shortage and these questions for access? How can patients access these treatments?
Well, there are several major problems. But the first major problem we have in the United States is that obesity treatment is not a standard benefit on our insurance policy. Despite the fact that the American Medical Association declared obesity a disease in 2013, so that was 11 years ago, we still have to, obesity treatment is still a carve out on insurance plans. And that's what we need to, that's what we advocate for, that I advocate for at the personal level, as well as at the Obesity Medicine Association level, is that we need to make it a standard benefit. Like, in other words, insurance companies don't, charge extra for cancer or, rheumatoid arthritis or Alzheimer's or these other diseases that we have, right? They're not carved out of an insurance plan. They're included when an employer gets insurance for their employees. You know, they know that they have inclusion of all these diseases if their employees get those diseases, right? But that's not the case with obesity. And we need to fix that tomorrow. Like, in my opinion, as a public health emergency, we just need to say, nope, it's a standard benefit on all insurance policies. If everyone's premium has to go up by $2, then that's what has to happen. I don't know what those economics exactly look like, but it isn't going to be going up by $100 or $200, right, of premiums, right? I mean, we're talking about potentially if we spread it out across everyone, that there may be a slight increase, but certainly hopefully not a huge increase in the premium portion. That's just the covering of obesity. We're not talking about the cost of the drugs, right? That's usually a separate thing, as that fully insured companies have to pay for the cost of their drugs as well, or a portion of the cost of their drugs as well. So it's a separate issue. But we need obesity treatment in and of itself a standard benefit, because we have drugs like phentermine and topiramate that we mentioned that cost like, $20, $30 a month if you use generic versions of them.
But they also likely to cause lots of
adverse effects. They're just different adverse effects, right? I mean, not everybody can take phentermine because it is a stimulant. So there are real contraindications to stimulants. And not everybody can take topiramate because there are contraindications such as kidney stones and other, issues that come along with that medication. But there are 100 and so we get back to the access issue.
Sure.
The problem is that there's 140 million Americans in the United States alone that qualify for treatment. 140 million.
Wow.
Yeah. And so again, that's a problem because we just can't get that meant. You know, we treat in the days prior to these effective medications, we were only treating 1% of the people 1% of those 140 million people. So now, even if we increase that to treating 10% of those patients, which is somewhat what potentially there's been some modeling that is occurring even now, like we're in the 5 to 10% treatment category, but that's still 10 million, 11 million patients. And there's two pharmaceutical companies can't make that much product is what we're seeing right now with the shortage.
Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly, right?
Yeah. And so, we're anxiously awaiting more companies, to get their drugs approved and get to market, right? More so because we just have such a demand, for treatment. that we need to, you know, figure this out, right? Because right now as well, you know, people are accessing various forms of medication that is not FDA approved out there, meaning there's stuff being sold at, you know, medical spas and other places that are that are just not as regulated as the stuff you get, you know, through the direct FDA channels, you know, of treatment, right? Meaning this is a drug that's been studied and tested in phase one, phase two, phase three clinical trials. And there's no generic versions of semaglutide or tirzepatide on the market, right? There are no generic versions. There's only the branded versions made by Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly. And that's, you know, becoming a huge issue for many of Americans that are turning to things that aren't, they have no idea what they're, in some cases, no way of validating, you know, what they're getting. And that's not okay. Again, that's why I think we have a public health emergency in front of us, that the government should step in just like with COVID and declare that this is a, this is the biggest public health problem we have from an obesity treatment, you know, obesity standpoint, right? The disease itself, public health emergency, but then access to treatment for the disease is another public health emergency that we need to work on, you know, how are we going to solve that?
The reality is that a lot of patients are now turning to different solutions, which you just alluded to, compounding pharmacies, which have a lot of different inactive ingredients, don't fall under that control, a regulatory control. What are some kinds of solutions that you think they should consider, you know, patients, providers, or even pharma companies and payers from different perspectives? Is it the formulation issue? How do you kind of get these drugs in the hands of patients that need them?
Well, I really do think, again, if the I have to admit, I don't formally understand what powers different forms of the government have in terms of enacting a public health emergency. But I would think if we had something like that, you know, we could, for example, you know, mandate that these be put into vials or some other type of delivery device that isn't as complicated as the current pen system. I know Eli Lilly has approval for Mounjaro, at least in different countries, and is putting it in vials, right? In order to be able to, this is old school, you know, vial and syringe, you know, and again, not as great for patients from a ease of use and safety and things like that, you know, but definitely if you could have that even for special, even for clinicians like myself that are very astute at prescribing and can explain that to patients, you know, how to do that, how to use that. But I would think that potentially there could be some solutions like this that we could come up with if we deemed it an actual emergent situation that then potentially we could be able to get access to, for patients, you know, in a more effective manner, right? And also, you know, we really need to coordinate care in the U.S. because, again, we're not doing anything to coordinate it. All the drug is coming into the country and it's just being sort of willy-nilly dispensed, right? It needs a prescription. It's not completely, you know, but I meant it's not being coordinated in that if I'm going on medication, hopefully I should be able to go on the next dose of medication, the next dose, and stay on the drug, right? Versus
the whole point of this kind of treatment for a chronic condition.
Right.
Right.
And we're not controlling for that in any way, shape, or form. So one patient might get on it and then the next patient gets on it and can't get the next dose, but the other patient can get the next dose, you know? And so it's like, it's very, we need to figure that out. And I do believe that, you know, we could figure that out if we, I mean, there are smart people in the country that could figure that out from a supply chain standpoint and hopefully do a little better job than we're doing today, which is just a little bit chaos at the moment. I mean, it really is chaos at the moment. And patients are switching back and forth from different compounds, and that can't be good. I mean, just in general, like, why is that? You know, that, I mean, not that it's harmful, certainly, but, you know, it certainly isn't the best type of care, you know, to have to switch from one medication to the other because of the shortage.
There's an issue with manufacturing across from the pharma perspective also, all right? I know that companies like you mentioned, manufacturers, they're now expanding the sites, manufacturing sites, and they're in order to meet the demands. global demands, right? The obesity is an issue not only in the United States, but globally as well. Thanks for bringing these to light. Give us a challenge, you know, a call to action to those who are listening, those who are in healthcare community, and also yourself in the spirit of this podcast, which, as you mentioned, is a combination of sportsmanship with the scientific method. The goal of which is to extend the boundaries of people as well as transcend their differences. Right? I know that I reviewed some of your previous interviews, and not only are you a co-founder of the Massachusetts Coalition for Action on Obesity, mm-hmm. But you were also an athlete, the first female athletic trainer back in high school. So I want to ask you how you can challenge us to stretch ourselves and lift others, those who listen, as well as those in the healthcare community. Your final message to us.
I love the idea of stretching yourself, right? And like you said, this idea of raising sort of all boats, right, with the tide. And I would just, you know, put a challenge out there to all of the, all of the commercial insurance companies today to just make obesity care a standard benefit. That doesn't mean everybody has to have access to the latest and greatest medication, but just obesity care, right? Meaning some of our older medications that are very effective for a certain percentage of patients, right? We could get a lot more people treated with generic, cheaper medications, or our branded medications of phentermine, topiramate, bupropion, naltrexone, so of Contrave and Qsymia, right? We have access to those medications. Let's improve access to those medications so that patients can get access to some care and figure out who those, 15 to 20% of people are that are going to respond to those medications, so that then we can have, greater access for the patients that need GLP-1s, in terms of them achieving their goals, right? And so, yeah. Again, we really need this to be a standard benefit amongst, all payers. We need all of us that are clinicians to, work on judiciously prescribing our medications, right? Trying to see if there are patients who would qualify for lower cost alternatives, so that we can, again, sort of reserve the higher cost, more effective medications for people who are really, sort of in need. And that's a hard thing to do, for sure, to be a good steward of our resources, but we're going to have to start doing that. I mean, because it is a challenge right now for all of us, to get that access we need. And then the call to action to the U.S. government, right, to pass the Treat and Reduce Obesity Act that's been before Congress for the past 12 years. If we pass that act, that would make obesity a standard benefit because Medicare would consider it a disease and a standard benefit. And then we would, be in a better place, right, to start addressing it as a public health emergency. I mean, I really do think it needs to be declared a public health emergency. We need to come together to figure out the supply chain, to figure out the supply demand issues, and to figure out, safe and effective ways to get more people access to care.
Yeah.
Comprehensive care, not just access to a medication. So again, we're talking about comprehensive care, where you're meeting, you're working on these lifestyle, the five P's, with a care team. Again, like sports, it's about a team. I work on a team every day. I have a dietitian, I have health coaches, I have nurse practitioners, physician assistants, pharmacists on my care team that are working every day to try to coordinate this care for patients. And so in the team spirit of everybody working together, let's provide comprehensive care, not just a medication for obesity, because a lot of the care has sort of turned into just getting patients medication, and we need to get them comprehensive care, not just medication.
Yeah, thank you very much for making that clear and for being a huge advocate for this community, for patients, for all of us providers. You are a chief medical officer and known well. The providers that you mentioned, I believe, are part of that whole organization at Known Well. I know your focus is part of the being a president with your role of the Obesity Medicine Association. Let us know how to contact you on KnownWell or what you know future project you're working on as well.
Well, I'm handing over the reins actually next week. So next week, Dr. Lydia Alexander will be taking over as president of the Obesity Medicine Association. I will become the past president. So okay. I'm very grateful for the time I've been able to spend, you know, as the president and look forward to being the past president so I can continue this work, you know, around, you know, getting access to care, to comprehensive care, you know, not just access to drugs, but access to comprehensive solutions. For chronic disease treatment, right? That's what KnownWell is about. We're about being the patient-centered medical home for people with obesity. We provide comprehensive metabolic health and obesity care for ages 13 and up. So we do take care of teenagers, and we also provide primary care for patients who are 18 and older. Okay. So again, you know, we're combining.
You're based in Boston, correct? And you're expanding, I believe.
Yeah. We're based out of the Boston area. We're in Needham, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston here. And we see patients in all of the New England states. So Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, the whole state of Massachusetts. We do 75% of our care via telemedicine. And we also are opening in Texas, as well as Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Northern Iowa. So we're beautiful. Looking forward to seeing patients. Oh, and I also see some patients in Ohio and Florida, but those are just minor areas. So we have a lot of patients, a lot of places, and we look forward to providing them with comprehensive longitudinal care for their chronic disease. And that's what we are doing at KnownWell.
Thank you very much for everything that you're doing to educate us and to provide the care that patients with obesity deserve. And I welcome you to come back. Those of you who listen to this podcast, make sure to subscribe to All Out Coach. If you didn't have a chance to ask Dr. Angela Fitch any questions, please make sure to contact her or me. I'll follow up with her directly. And with that, thank you again. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
You too. Thank you for all you do.